Okay, could I ask people to take their seats, please? And let's proceed. Sorry, we're running late. I know there was confusion about the entrance to the building, which is a mystery. And but we want to get started. Also, I hope nobody has parked on a street that says no parking on game days, because they will tow. They run, they wait until the moment, and then they run by and they tow everybody. It's like a big money maker for the city. So, okay. Otherwise, we're just running late. So, lunch will be right across the that open area, right outside here, and then you go through past the down a hallway to a terrace that is set up for us. So just follow the crowd. If you've ordered a box lunch, if you haven't ordered a box lunch, there are a few extras, but you need to deal with Barbara Stack about that. And otherwise, there are some places across the street that you can find something to eat at. I don't know if there are any other announcements, but so we'll get started. As usual, things have gotten a little sketchy as we've done this. I need somebody to read a statement about Beth Stapleton that Sid has written. Is there anyone who knew Beth who would read the statement? Otherwise, I'll just give it to somebody arbitrarily to read. Anybody? There are a couple of people who I had a volunteer for last night, and I don't know. I didn't write down the name of the volunteer in the right place. So is there somebody here who is going to talk about Bob Starobin? No? And Eli Katz? Somebody had volunteered. All right. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Okay. All right. So I would like to start first with a statement about some of our deceased attorneys. And Peter Frank, who was one of those attorneys, but who was very much alive and with us, is going to read a statement about them. So, Peter.
Thanks, Lynn. Just go. Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. First, I want to say, don't overrate the role of us attorneys. Attorneys in society are really stenographers to power. Some of us were stenographers to you because of the power of your action. There's a tendency to give us too much credit. That said, most of the attorneys I'm going to mention were active with the National Lawyers Guild, as I am now and was then. And the Guild's philosophy is our role is to keep the movement in the streets, and that's what we tried to do with you guys. Bob Truhaft was a mentor, his older generation, was a mentor to many of us, probably was in the CP early in his career, practiced in this area for many years. He had the distinct honor of being arrested in Sproul Hall with you guys by Ed Meese, who later became, who was no Eric Holder, who became the Attorney General of the United States under Reagan. A wonderful, and committed person. Born in 1912 and apparently died in 2001 and was active every day of that. Alex Hoffman, who many of you may remember, lived at the time with Elsa Knight Thompson, who was the wonderful program director at KPFA. What?
I'll talk about Elsa.
Okay. Alex gave you guys some connections to that media world and to the sort of world of the political people who'd been active in a whole variety of things at the time. He was really a consigliere, is that how you say the word? To you guys.
Consigliere.
Consigliere. Norm Leonard was a wonderful labor lawyer, died as late as 2006, had been an attorney for Harry Bridges, and was brought gravitas to us lawyers group, which I certainly didn't have, being one of the absolutely youngest and newly minted lawyers. Aubrey Grossman was a people's lawyer and a tactician, did a wonderful job for everybody, and there was Stan Gold, and there were others. Maybe we can highlight them in the list, but we remember the lawyers who put so much into this and into many other struggles. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. The next person I would like to call on is Steve Lustig, who is going to read a statement first from Leon Wofsy. Leon will be at the panel this afternoon talking about the radical legacy of the 60s. He's 92 now and still hale and hearty, but it would have been a very long day for him to be here this morning. So he has written a statement about our faculty supporters who were so critical to our success, and Steve will read it.
Okay, so I'm channeling Leon at the moment. Reggie Zelnick and Larry Levine were the best of the best. Both young, new, and vulnerable assistant professors of history, they were closest in age and in spirit to the FSM. Both went on in their short lives to be highly admired scholars, but they never lost the courage, integrity, and compassion that made them among the first and most effective faculty friends of FSM. Their students and everyone who knew them loved them. They were among the dearest friends of my lifetime. Gone now are many faculty who constituted or who were active supporters of the Committee of 200. Among those whose memory we honor are Owen Chamberlain, Jacobus Tenbrook, Kenneth Stamp, Philip Zelznick, Norm Jacobson, Michael Rogan, Jack Scharr, Charles Muscatine, Joe Tussman, Patricia St. Lawrence, Richard Stroman, Gerald Berryman, Roger Stanier, Howard Byrne, Josephine Miles, Tom Parkinson, and David Kretsch.
Okay, I would like to read now a statement that I wrote about a number of the people who, in the community who gave us tremendous moral and practical support. Elsa Knight Thompson was director of public affairs at KPFA. She saw to it that our rallies were covered live by the wonderful Burton White, who was still living, thank goodness. And she gave us a great deal of airtime. KPFA was our loyal friend because of her. She was abrasive. She didn't suffer fools gladly. And she was a passionate supporter of progressive causes and a loyal friend of Mario's and mine. Howard Jeter was a community activist who was the first African-American substitute teacher in Berkeley. He was a visible presence at every FSM rally and brought us a little bit of diversity, which we sorely needed. Before and after FSM, he fought for fair housing and other civil rights measures, and his son wrote when he died, "He really was a stickler for his rights because he expected others to benefit from him fighting battles," which could be said of us, too. Ann Lippo was a librarian at UC Berkeley who turned a blind eye to the very erratic hours of the students who were supposed to be working in the library but who were out on the plaza supporting the FSM. She fought against mandated filtering systems on public library computers and against discriminatory pay for women librarians. After Mario's death, it was Anne who encouraged her husband, Steve Silberstein, to make his massive gift to the university library in the name of the FSM. This was a gift that made us respectable in the university's eyes and brought us the wonderful FSM Cafe, which you can laugh, but it's where a lot of people, a lot of students, first encounter the name of the FSM and any information whatsoever about the FSM. So we are an eternal presence as long as the university survives. Ralph Gleason was the first newspaper writer who actually got us, who wrote the first laudatory column about the FSM called The Tragedy at the Greek Theater. And he observed in that, the ultimate tragedy is that the older generation will never see how wrong it is, how deeply it has misjudged these youngsters, how sadly it has maligned them, and how deviously it has taken refuge in rhetoric and in legalities when the youth has been speaking in plain moral terms. He and his wonderful wife, Jean, opened their home and their hearts to us and provided a place of peace and revitalization and put us in touch with a lot of musical supporters, including Joan Baez. And finally, but not at all least, there was the FSM shrink, Neil Blumenfeld, a passionate social justice advocate who counseled us, tried to explain us to the larger world, and explain the world to us. Why do they hate us so much? Neil was asked. And his answer was because we were both moral and successful. We wish they were all here with us physically today, but they are in our hearts. And now I would like to call on some individuals to read very brief statements. Let's start with Lee, who is going to mention Michael Rossman. And if you have been asked to read a statement about somebody, could you please maybe line up so that we don't waste a lot more time?
Okay. The FSM Archives was founded on the recognition that we were now elders, and we were the responsibility of elders. But Michael Rossman became an elder at age 24 when he initiated the compilation of what became known as the Rossman Report, an exhaustive historical compilation of UC's suppression of political and social activity that provided a strong foundation for the FSM's position and earned him a place on the FSM steering committee, where he became the principal author of a significant fraction of the FSM's daily leaflets and acquired the sobriquet Everybody's Jewish Uncle. The FSM was thereafter Michael's lodestone, the point of reference from which all was measured, driving his quest to explore the world of alternative education, shaping the basis of his books, and driving him to lead the organization of FSM reunions and to serve as president of the Free Speech Movement Archives from its formation until his death. Ever the romantic, Michael wrote of how he had encountered the muse of history at the police car in 1964 and had submitted himself to that muse's inspiration, becoming more than anyone else the leading organizer and agitator in propagating the history, ideals, and accomplishments of the FSM, explicating, as written in the FSM Archives Statement of Purpose, quote, its roots and antecedents, its events, and its subsequent consequences, influences, and interpretations, unquote, a phrase that only Michael could have written. I'm asked to announce that there are some DVDs out there, about 40 of them. That's of an interview with Michael and Mario. So you can, anyone can pick them up if they wish.
Yes, I'm going to say a few remarks about Steve Hamilton. Steve Hamilton's family came out from the South. They were what you could have said Okies, and they were part of the war industry. Steve actually was devoutly religious, and he got a prize from Bank of America in his sophomore year for writing an essay about the evils of communism. And he came to Berkeley, and he ended up on the executive committee representing the churches. The next thing I knew about him, he ended up in the Progressive Labor Party. He was the only person ever thrown out of HUAC for heckling. So he was thrown out of HUAC, I think it was in 1969. Went on to, become a gay activist and a therapist. He was my best friend and brother, and he was somebody who could always count on to cover your back.
I will ask, let's not applaud each one. Let's wait till the end, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to say a few words about Dusty Miller. I don't have anything prepared, but we were a movement which was blessed with an incredibly brilliant intellectual leadership who could form words and who could form concepts and quote philosophers and make arguments of the most dazzling sort. But when people looked around the car and noticed that most of the people sitting there they didn't know, weren't part of any of the political groups on campus, and wondered, where did these folks come from? What are they about? And a guy with curly hair got up there, and he was angry, and he didn't talk about Thomas Aquinas or Greek philosophers. He was talking the voice of the Southern California beach. And he was talking for all of us who were just tired of these grown-ups in suits trying to tell us what to do when they obviously didn't know. And Dusty spoke with the language not of Karl Marx but of Groucho and put that cream pie right in their face. We had people coming from the head. Dusty was all from the heart. And without him, we would never have been the success that we were. He wished that he could have lived to be here with us today. He didn't make it, but we remember him. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm going to speak a few words about Hal Draper and then end up with a few words about Ann Draper. Hal Draper was a lifelong left-wing socialist, and he was a little bit older than the FSM generation. When I got here in Berkeley, he was working in the library. And he was an inspiration and a mentor to many of the free speech activists. And he was different than many of the others. He never interfered or engaged in our day-to-day deliberations, but he was always there to give his thoughts and his advice whenever we act. And I can think of three important contributions that Hal made to the FSM. The first was before the police car incident. He gave a talk on campus analyzing Clark Kerr's book, The Uses of the Multiversity. And it was called Clark Kerr's View of the University as a Factory. And he explained how in Clark Kerr's vision, the university was a servant to society and was treating us as the raw materials, as we later interpreted. And he gave us the rhetoric that Mario and I and others used throughout the FSM to describe what was happening to us. So that was his first contribution that I want to recall. The second was right after the police car incident, and there was a truce, and we broke up. And I was a little bit upset. I thought we had them, and I didn't know that we really should have agreed to anything. I was a little bit of a hothead then. And Hal took me aside. I spoke to him, and he said, "You have just now won collective bargaining. Treat this as a union would treat this. You've won collective bargaining. Now make it work." And he was exactly right. And that helped me understand what our mission was for the next weeks and months when we are fighting with the university and trying to negotiate and playing the role of negotiators, which we ended up doing very well. But it was his image and his framing of what we are to do that helped me understand what our next step was. And finally, Hal wrote a book, Berkeley, The New Student Revolt, in which he was mainly answering all the former leftists who became the proto-neocons who were attacking us, and he was explaining us in a way that made sense. And it's a history of our movement that's still very – it's a political history of the FSM that's still very valuable today. Ernie Haberkern's out in the hall selling copies, if you don't remember it. He said everybody comes up, so I have it in an attic somewhere. But if you want to refresh your thinking, it's out in the library. And there, very briefly, Ann Draper, Hal's wife, and they were a team, and you can't talk about Hal without talking about Ann. Ann was a union organizer and a union staffer. She worked for what was then the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. She was a quieter presence on the campus. But she, too, was a mentor for many young people to help us understand that there was more to the world than just us students. Thank you. And she was also the first feminist activist that I ever met.
Hi, I'm Anita Metal, and I'm going to read a tribute to Beth Stapleton. Beth grew up on a farm and was by nature and preference a quiet and thoughtful person until she became passionate about something, and the university's attempt to prevent our participation in the civil rights movement stirred her outrage. She was a fearless fighter and took her suspension in stride without ever slowing down. An underlying optimism grew out of her experience in the FSM. Things can change, and they can change with lightning speed, as the fall of 1964 showed. Despite serious struggle with depression, Beth was convinced that the FSM gave hope for a better future.
Beth, if you don't remember, Beth was one of the original people who was cited for sitting at a table.
I was asked to say a few words about Pete Cameo, and it will be easier to keep this short because I actually didn't know him during the free speech movement fight. But he came from Venezuela, a longtime socialist activist. His brother was in jail in Mexico for many years. And what I remember most vividly about Pete Cameo was the tremendous talent he had for speaking in ways that people could understand. Now, whenever he would come through town and he'd tell you about a demonstration, we always had to, take account of the CEF, the Cameo exaggeration factor, to put it down a little bit. But that was the flip side of his tremendous enthusiasm. If you can ever find a picture or a clip of him debating Teddy Kennedy in Boston, you should look for it. He had an amazing ability to take controversial ideas, put them into very personal examples with a touch of humor that could make people see the truth of them, even if they didn't agree.
Thank you. First, I left out two faculty members, Richard Stroman and Gerald Berriman, and I think they were very involved. But I want to make some comments about my brother, Jeff, who was a huge influence on my life. He was my older brother, and he came to Berkeley before I did, and he got very involved with Slate immediately, and then also in the travel ban trips to Cuba, trying to break the travel ban. When he came back from that, he became involved in the free speech movement, and then the anti-war movement after that, but also picked up on the free university idea and founded the Free University of Berkeley, which I think several people in here were involved in. He went on to teach at a number of universities. He was in political science and became a professor of government at Sacramento State and founded the California Studies Association. And that's an incredible organization, if you can ever see it. It brings together, someone says, truck drivers, college professors, and artists, and it's often the same person. So the combination of what he brought together, the richness of California, both land and water policy, the people, the artists, the creativity, was fascinating and interesting. And out of it came a lot of work with the legislature also. He was a huge influence on my life and on many people, and I miss him. Thanks.
One afternoon, just about 50 years ago, my friend Ron Anastasi and I were standing at the edge of a crowd who were sitting around a police car. And Ron turned to me. Someone was on the car trying to make himself heard. And Ron turned to me and said, "You know, what these people need is a public address system." So we hopped in my old Plymouth and we went and rented a Plymouth address, a public address system. And miraculously, someone let us plug it in. Ron and I were tremendously pleased when the crowd grew. I like to say, we brought technology to the free speech movement. But it was really Ron's smarts and enthusiasm and imagination that made the difference. Ron went on to make a big difference to the free speech movement, applying those qualities of head and heart to the steering committee and being involved in a great many activities and really helping to run the organization for several months. By the spring of 65, when I really last saw him, I had a sense that Ron had been transformed by the new possibilities of participation and the new world that was that could happen. I lost touch with Ron then, but thanks to Lynn, I have recently learned that after earning a PhD at MIT, Ron went on to make a distinguished career that fundamentally at its core was applying, imagining and applying appropriate technology to enable and expand humane human purposes. I miss Ron here now. I'm sure he would find a way to make a difference.
I don't know if you've heard of Michael Klein. He was one of the many arrested. I didn't know him when he was in the free speech movement, but I met him at Rutgers, and we cooperated on a Vietnam legacy conference, which was examined the Vietnam legacy. And that's when I learned that he was also among those who were arrested during the free speech movement. Michael died in 1993, and he had a significant life as a scholar activist, and one of his books was from Hanoi to Vietnam. I mean, from Hollywood to Vietnam. From Hanoi to Hollywood, the Vietnam War in American Film. It's still in publication, and Michael was the sort of person that you would be proud of. He was among many of you and others who went on with their lives to do significant work in the activist era. Thank you.
David C. Piper was the night attendant at the games room in the ASUC. And when XCOM would end, I would come tell him what had been discussed and what had been decided. By the end of the FSM semester, there was 85 people every night coming into the games room to talk about what XCOM had done and decide what to do before the leaflets were handed out the next morning. One of the main reasons the FSM succeeded was that we had communication not only from the top down, but from the bottom up. And this kind of thing was a significant link in that communication. You will never see Dave's picture anywhere in pictures of the FSM because he was always working the back of the rally, finding out where the cops were gathering, talking to people who were not committed, hearing what was on the mind, hearing what they were saying to each other. And then that information would get funneled up so that we were able to produce a unified and united front when we needed it.
I'm speaking about Alice Huberman and Joey LaPenta. I didn't know Alice very well during FSM, but she was an arrestee. And afterwards, I'm told she worked with Jackie at Spider magazine. She traveled to Europe, became an incredible cook from Tuscany, had her own restaurant in northern New York, but would never call herself a chef, which was pretentious. She was a talented and artistic person who died about a month ago. She was planning to come to the reunion. Anybody who knew Joey knew that he was the life of the party. On the FSM Christmas carols, the person whose crazed voice raises above the others, that's Joseph. He was a graduate student in literature going to his PhD, and after the FSM, he finished his master's, got married, came out, got divorced, went to Japan, and taught English there, and wrote for English publications, and became an Ikebana master, which very few Westerners have ever done anyway. he had a good time during the FSM and helped us do it too.
Thanks. Well, Lynn asked me to say a few words about Margot Adler, who died about 6 weeks ago. I had been in correspondence with her. I did not know that the cancer had recurred, and I was totally devastated when I learned of her death. She was in jail with me. That's when I really remember meeting her. But Margot had a more than 30-year career with NPR, National Public Radio, and was the head of their New York office. And many people who didn't remember her face, everybody remembered her voice, because she did such wonderful broadcasting for NPR and did so many marvelous things and extra programs that always focused on social justice and peace and radical activity. She was also a leader of the Wiccan movement, wrote a classic study called Drawing Down the Moon, which is still in print, of the witchcraft movement, part of the feminist movement of the 70s. And her most recent book, before that, she also wrote an autobiography called Heretic's Heart, which is a marvelous book, and then which has a lot about FSM in it. And then her last book, and I don't remember the title of it, but it's about vampires and doing a political take on vampires and all the vampire novels and science fiction and so forth. And it's very good. So Margot's here with us in spirit, I am sure, and I embrace her. Thank you.
I've been asked to speak about Bob Kaufman and Stevie Lipney, both of whom I knew during the Civil Rights Movement first, where a lot of us started before we got to FSM. In 1961, I guess I was a junior, we were both here on campus, but I only met Bob in Los Angeles as part of my Freedom Ride group on our way to the South. And he was a natural leader and chosen by us to be our spokesperson. And in the South, in jail, was severely beaten and had to be hospitalized and have a lot of stitches. He was always a very gentle, soft-spoken person with his pipe and his pictures on the FSM cafe wall. I'm not sure exactly what he did during FSM, but I know that soon after he died young from stomach cancer and is sorely missed. Also, at the same time, around 1961, I met Stevie Lipney, who was a high school student in San Fernando Valley, where we were organizing with CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, to raise money for our Freedom Rides. And she was at a table. I still have a photo of her next to a sign saying, "Send a kid to jail." And she helped raise money for our trips south. And later, here in Berkeley, we were both in the Du Bois Club. And testament to the times, she got, quote, knocked up, unquote, and abortion was illegal. And so a couple of the Hallinan brothers took her to Tijuana where they could get her an abortion. And afterwards, she and I drove to New York and I rent a car to get away from California for a while. And she was a very quirky artist, wild spirit. And what I remember about that trip, driving to New York, was that we had both memorized the 2,000-year-old man album with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, and we entertained each other by trading parts all the way across. She is also shown on a lot of photographs of FSM singing with the singer group. I don't know what you called yourselves back then. And probably did a lot of the wonderful artwork. And afterwards, I lost my apartment. She took my boyfriend and me into her house. She was always a very generous spirit to me. And so we miss them both.
So is Ringo here? He was going to say a few words about a couple of other people, but so we would like to have you read the name when I'll give you on the count of three. We'll read the name that is highlighted on your sheet, and then we will all shout Presente. So find the highlighted name. No, wait. One, two, three. Okay. Joe Hacker. Presente. And Bruce is going to lead us in singing. And then there is a video of Mario, which many of you who come to the lecture may have seen, but a lot of you don't get to the lecture because you live out of town, so we thought maybe you would like to see it. It memorializes Mario, but it also pays tribute to the rest of us. So, Bruce? I hope there's enough of us who know the tune to this, so we'll sort of carry along the rest of us.
Also know the words.
Yeah. We got that on the thing.
So okay. Turn to your hymnals. I'd like to make one observation. For the first time in my life, walking yesterday up Telegraph, I realized that from Durant to Bancroft is a hill.
This is Bruce Barthel, by the way. He was one of the youngest of us.
Still. Okay. Arise, ye oops, wrong song. All right.
Say what?
There's a man by my side walking. There's a voice within me talking. There's a voice within me saying, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. Send their dogs to bite our bodies. Cuts up in prison. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on. And can't go on any longer. Take the hand of your sister and brother. Every victory brings another. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on. And again. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on. Carry it on.
If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents and his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider if this is affirmed, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, and I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
But today's rally in front of Sproul Hall has taken on a different tone. Several thousand students have gathered for what has been billed as a victory celebration, a victory the students feel is assured as a result of yesterday's action by the Academic Senate.
We're asking that there be no restrictions on the content of speech save those provided by the courts. And that's an enormous amount of freedom. And people can say things within that area of freedom which are not responsible. And now we've finally gotten into a position where we have to consider being responsible because, now we have the freedom within which to be responsible. And I'd like to say, at this time, I'm confident that the students and the faculty, University of California, will exercise their freedom with the same responsibility they've shown in winning their freedom.
I had a very bad stammer, the worst stammer that I absolutely have ever encountered in anyone. I stammered for years very, very badly. In high school, right up through high school, it started to subside on the last day of high school. I delivered the valedictory. I stumbled on the first word, and the rest came out smooth. And then thereafter, over a period of a couple of years, the stammer gradually disappeared. An unusual pattern. So for me, I've read about, who wouldn't? I've read about stammers. Quite an unusual pattern. Now, to me, in addition to its political meaning and its, moral and philosophical meaning, the free speech movement was a pun. My free speech movement, freeing up the movement of my speech movement. And so I was also very much sort of deeply, viscerally involved in the idea of free speech. I have to say, for me, the sort of the deepest free speech quote for me is Diogenes is attributed, what is attributed to Diogenes. And he said, the most beautiful thing in the world is the freedom of speech. And those words are in me as they're sort of burned into my soul. Because for me, free speech was not a tactic, not something to win for political. To me, free speech, freedom of speech, is something that represents the very dignity of what a human being is. If you cannot speak, that's what marks us off. That's what marks us off from the stones and the stars. Okay, you can speak freely. That is, it's almost impossible to describe to me. It is almost impossible for me to describe, but it is really the thing that marks us as just below the angels. I don't want to push this beyond where it should be pushed. But I feel it.
We knew people from 30 years ago when we were students, and we were not that close to them. Their issues were not that close to our issues. But the issues that we fought for and developed over the 60s and the 70s, and mostly the 60s actually, are the issues of today. We actually are closer to students today. The agenda, the national agenda, is the agenda that we created. What is that agenda? Okay? You can put it in the simple version is it's anti-hierarchy. But what does it mean? Anti-hierarchy in race, anti-hierarchy in gender, anti-hierarchy in class, anti-hierarchy in the environment. It's not one species über alles, right? Anti-hierarchy in the empire, not one nation über alles. Those five, actually, that's the five that Cornel West is happy to name. One could, you know, name four or name six, but there they are, okay? Race, gender, class, environment, empire. That is the agenda that we began the creation of, and that is today's agenda. I believe people have a desire. I think there's actually a desire for solidarity, for seeing things from the other person's point of view. And I've seen it many times. Trade unionists who are very, very hard bitten, and they're all, you know, if was that a good contract? But on the line, the enthusiasm on the line is tremendous. Where does that come from? They're doing something together. See, they're doing something. It's not just against the bosses. It's with your brothers and with your sisters. I've seen that happen. And I believe there is a deep hunger that people have for doing right by one's brothers and sisters. And so there may be like a hidden reservoir that works for us. That's almost like a faith, okay? And, you know, in other words, how can I prove that? Well, I prove it if we finally win.
Well, we're only running half an hour late, so you'll have a shorter lunch, I think. So, Bettina, could you come up and take over now, and we will begin our panels. I hope everybody knows the rooms and everything of this afternoon panels. See Barbara if you don't.
Hello, beautiful people. It's impossible to see that and not cry. Okay. So, thank you, Lynn, for putting together the memorial for us.
I want to thank Karen McClellan, who did all the work on that. And, you know, I just can't deal with it now.